Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Everywhere we turn, from news to books and movies, we're bombarded with the same hackneyed message. Human nature is inherently bad. Just look at all the senseless violence, the greed, murder, rape and war around us. We humans, it seems, are genetically wired for selfish, cruel behaviour. Or are we? Are violence, greed, domination and control really a fundamental and ineradicable part of human nature? Absolutely not, says cultural historian, social systems scientist and author Rianne Eisler, whose international bestseller, The Chalice and the Blade, has been hailed as the most important book since Darwin's Origin of Species. Rianne Eisler joins me now to discuss her latest book, Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Brains, Lives and Future, co-authored with anthropologist Douglas P. Fry. In this book, they both upend age-old assumptions about human nature and provide irrefutable evidence that not only is caring behaviour humanity's default tendency, but also that we can build more humane and sustainable societies. Rianne Eisler, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Your book, Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Minds, Lives and Future, makes very sobering reading. My goodness. I've been reading it over the past 2 weeks, and the deeper I got into it, I didn't know whether to be elated or to be depressed. The statistics are pretty darn horrifying. The global pandemic of violence against children. And yet you also paint a picture of how we can be. And, you know, that is the part that for me, you know, finished on a note of hope about what sort of society we can create if we pay attention to what is needed. Now, I want to ask you, your book, The Chalice and the Blade, sold more than 500,000 copies worldwide. And LA Weekly said that it may be the most significant work published in all our lifetimes. And I think it was the well-known Chilean author, Isabel Allende, who said it's one of those magnificent key books that can transform us and initiate fundamental changes in the world. Now, that was published in 1988, 31 years ago. What inspired you to write this new book 31 years later? Is it because those fundamental changes are not being initiated?
Well, that is certainly part of it. Another part of it is simply that as the years have gone by, my research has deepened and broadened. And so I, in this last book, in Nurturing Our Humanity, I combine my research, my new approach to understanding human societies with two new, very, very important areas. One is neuroscience, because what we're learning in terms of the conceptual framework introduced in my work is what the subtitle says, that nothing less than our brains develop differently in the cultures that orient more to the partnership or the domination side of the social continuum. The second area, I've been working on this book for 10 years, and 3 years ago, I invited Doug Fry to be my co-author because he is one of the world's authorities on foraging societies. And we're all familiar with that old story, aren't we, about, well, certainly, selfish genes, evolutionary mm-hmm. imperatives. Too bad, you know. That's just how we developed. So rape and killing and injustice, they're just human nature. And what he shows, well, he calls foraging societies, which is how we humans lived for millennia, the original partnership societies. So this book really, as I said, also ends with some very practical and very important cornerstones that my research shows are really essential if we're to, well, to move to a more equitable and sustainable future.
It seems that over the past few decades, we are devolving rather than evolving. We're seeing, you know, a move away from globalism. We're seeing, you know, tribalism, a resurgence there. We're seeing a lot of fundamentalism. We're seeing so much more displacement of people and abuse of humans by other humans, which, you know, really paints an awful picture. What is happening? Are we just hearing about it more? Has it always been like this, you know, in recent history? Or is something happening to create this division?
It's a combination. Certainly we're hearing about it more. I mean, it used to be that violence against women and children was ignored, frankly. Even here in the United States, if there was what they like to call domestic violence, I call it intimate violence, all the police did, if they were called, was just walk the guy around the block so he could go back home and do it again, right? So that is part of the forward movement. This said, we are also in the midst of what I call a massive regression to the domination side of the partnership domination social scale. And all of the things that you mentioned really are part of that regression. They're not isolated. They're not random. They are part of a pattern. And I have in my work, as you know, written about how really history is not linear. You know, this whole notion of a linear movement from, quote, barbarism to, quote, civilization is nonsense. I mean, we've had, yes, if you look at the European Middle Ages and you look at today, there's been a tremendous forward movement. I mean, sometimes I say it as a joke that when I get depressed about what's happening, I think of the European Middle Ages. They looked a lot like the Taliban, the Inquisition, the Crusades, mm-hmm. the witch burnings. Women had no rights. Children had no rights. But we've had one regression after another. I was born into one, the rise of Hitler in Europe, first in Germany and then my native Austria. So this new book really addresses this very frontally, and the four cornerstones that it ends with are essential if we are to have the foundations that will avoid these regressions.
When I finished reading your book, I went on to Wikipedia and I started looking at the statistics for school shootings. And I was actually shocked to see that records existed back to 1840. And I counted all of the school shootings in this century, the 21st century. And I was shocked by the statistics. Now, your research demonstrates that the tragic shootings of the past several years may well stem from the impact of growing up in a domination culture or family that supports these rigid top-down rankings. And, of course, it's all ruled by fear and force. Could you just tell us a little bit about the differences between a domination culture and a partnership culture, just so that we can get an idea of what we're looking at here?
Well, when I embarked on my research, which was really to understand why there is so much violence and so much injustice, I immediately saw, well, not immediately, but it became very clear that using the conventional social categories like right versus left, religious versus secular, Eastern versus Western, Northern versus Southern, and so on, were useless in terms of answering that question. If you think about it, there have been repressive, violent regimes in all these categories. But one of the things that is very different about the new categories and these old categories between the partnership and domination systems and these old categories is that the old categories either ignore or marginalize the status of the majority of humanity, women and children. And they focus primarily on what I call the top of the domination pyramid, politics and economics, as conventionally defined. But it's in families, as you said, Sandy, it's in families that children first learn what is normal or abnormal, possible or impossible, a moral they're taught, right? And in domination families, children are taught that using violence, physical discipline against children, right, or they observe violence against their mothers usually, that's okay, that's moral. So what do they learn? That it's okay to use violence, to impose your will. And this is a basic lesson for maintaining domination systems. It's also a basic lesson for what it means to be a man. I mean, notice that these shootings are almost exclusively men and young men, and they have been socialized to not be like a woman, right? Which means soft, caring, you know, nonviolence, caregiving. They're not supposed to be that way. And the gun in the United States, of course, is a symbol of manhood, isn't it? So you put all of that together, but I think that if we really were to look at these shootings, at the shooters, there was a lot of pain in every one of their backgrounds. And it's the deflection of that anger, which they can't express against the adults who cause it, right, in their families, against an out-group that is characteristic of domination in group versus out-group thinking, whether it's Sunni versus Shia or Shia versus Sunni in the Middle East or white against dark-skinned races in the United States. It doesn't matter. It's part of the domination system, and it really has its roots in the family, but the family doesn't arise in isolation. It's interactive, right, with the other social institutions, religion, politics, economics, yes, education. So you have to look at societies not in terms of simple linear causes and effects, but in terms of interactions. And you cannot, if you leave out the foundational parent-child and gender relations, as most studies still do, most sociology courses still do, well, you can't see the whole picture, can you? And you leave out a huge part of the picture, and you can't see the connections. You cannot connect the dots.
You know, a few years ago when ISIS was at its height and was on the news all the time, I heard a story about a member of ISIS who killed his own mother. And I don't remember why he killed, but she said something that he didn't like or wanted him to do something that he didn't want to do. And I was so shocked, and I could not believe, how is it that somebody could kill their mother, after reading your book? And I understand, you know, what domination culture and environment does, you know, to a child's brain, and to, you know, the chemistry as well is involved in that. It gave me some insight into how that can happen. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the science here that backs up what you're saying?
the science is very clear. And unfortunately, the way that these studies are usually reported is just in relation to a particular individual or at the most a particular family. But looking at them from a larger social perspective is really eye-opening because I'll back up for a second. It's really not coincidental that the subordination of women is key to all these repressive, violent societies, whether it's religious fundamentalists like ISIS or religious fundamentalists right here in the United States, whether it's secular societies like Hitler's Germany or on the left, Stalin's former Soviet Union or Kim Jong-un's North Korea. They're made of the same cloth, and it's so important. You know, linguistic psychologists tell us that the categories provided by a culture really channel our thinking. And this is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance of really looking at the whole picture and starting to use these new categories, which identify configurations, connections. But to get to your question about the neuroscience, one thing that we are learning is that it's not only our feelings and our beliefs, but actually that what children experience and observe early on leaves an imprint on the brain itself. I mean, this is sort of neuroscience 1A, right? And what we're learning is, well, domination systems, I think of them as really trauma factories, stress factories. Children learn to either fight or flight, or, you know, they go into addiction very often, which is a form of flight. And the thing that really happens is denial, whether it's denial of climate change or denial of the parents on which you are dependent for life, right, as a child, are causing you pain, and are learning to instead deflect that pain and rage and anger to outgroups. And really what we are learning from neuroscience is the importance of environment, which for humans, of course, is cultural environments, that this whole notion of is it nature or nurture, it's a non-issue. The issue is gene expression. And, for example, one study showed that there's a certain gene that some men have which predisposes men to be violent. However, only men, only those men who in their childhood had what we call adverse childhood experiences turned out to be violent. So genes, there is no such thing really as genetic determinism. It's always the interaction with the culture.
You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. My guest today is social systems scientist, cultural historian, and best-selling author of The Chalice and the Blade, Rianne Eisler. We're talking about her latest book, Nurturing Humanity, in which she and her co-author share a blueprint for how we can eradicate domination, violence, rape, hate crimes, and supremacist thinking by building more humane and sustainable societies. We'll be back in a few moments. Stay tuned.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Rianne Eisler, you're president of the Center for Partnership Studies, and you've addressed the United Nations General Assembly, the U.S. Department of State, and congressional briefings. You've authored over 500 articles. You grew up, as you mentioned earlier, in Nazi Europe during the war. What was it like for you to escape the horrors and the humiliations of Nazi Europe, only to find that the promised land of American liberty and equality had its own problems with prejudice and persecution?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because for one thing, my passion for this work, and I do have a great deal of passion for it, is of course rooted in my experience as a refugee child, as an immigrant, with my parents from Nazi Europe. And I grew up in the industrial slums of Havana because, of course, the Nazis confiscated, that's an official word for armed robbery, everything my parents had, until my parents got on their feet. So I experienced poverty, another traumatic and really unjust. I mean, Cuba at that time under Batista, the gaps between haves and have-nots were simply enormous. But when we came to the United States, you know, the promised land, one of the things that we found was, of course, racism in Florida. And at that time, still, there was strict segregation. And I don't know whether my father really was the first one to decide to do a sit-in, or whether he really, as he said, that he just didn't understand English well enough, but he sat in the colored section of a drugstore. We were fascinated that drugstores sold sodas, you know, food, because, you know, that was not something in either Europe or in Cuba that we found. And, of course, he was told he had to leave, and he said, no, I mean, I'm sitting here. You know, this is a good place for me to sit. But it was really rather horrifying to see the extreme poverty. And, yes, again, the gaps between haves and mm-hmm. have-nots, and this time on the basis of race. But now I understand that this is all part of what I call a domination system. And we have come by this because we inherited it. You know, in The Chalice and the Blade, and again in Nurturing Our Humanity, there is data, and by now it's really such incontrovertible data, that for millennia we lived in societies that were more egalitarian, more gender balanced. And as the archaeologist who excavated Çatalhöyük, one of the largest early farming societies ever found, wrote, there's no signs in the DNA evidence of that being born male or female made any difference in terms of status or life options. And, of course, they were more peaceful. Çatalhöyük, there are no signs of warfare for over 1,000 years. But then there was a shift, what in The Chalice and the Blade I called a 5,000-year domination detour. And we've inherited really a lot of traditions of domination. In fact, if you look at the modern progressive social movements, every last one of them, they're not random and disconnected. They've all challenged traditions of domination, whether it was challenging the so-called divinely ordained right of kings to rule over their subjects, or the so-called divinely ordained right of men to rule over the women and children in their homes, or again, the so-called divinely ordained right of a, quote, superior race to rule over, quote, inferior ones, all the way to the environmental movement challenging our once hallowed conquest of nature, which at our level of technological development could do us in. But, and this is really a point that I think we need to understand, and that nurturing our humanity has all of the hard data to really document it. Most of these movements have only focused on dismantling what I call the top of the domination pyramid, politics, economics, as conventionally defined, but it's on the foundational parent-child and gender relations that these regressions keep rebuilding the domination system. Why was it a top priority for Hitler to return to a, quote, traditional family, which is, of course, code for an authoritarian, rigidly male-dominated, highly punitive family? Why is that a top priority for, say, ISIS or for the Taliban, you know, religious domination regimes? Why historically do we see this connection, right? Because we need to look at it. But a problem is this, and I don't want to keep going on, but if you really think, out of 1,600 years of so-called modern Western science, only 50 years ago did women's studies, men's studies, gender studies, queer studies even enter the university, and it's still marginalized, right?
Mm.
So we've come by this honestly. Our social categories leave this out. Most studies leave it out. Our education leaves it out. And child development, it's still taught, when it's taught at all, as sort of siloed, right, in connection with families or with child development. Rather, it should be part of sociology, should be part of political science, economics, and that's what this book does.
Yes, it does. I mean, it is such a thought-provoking book. It just taught me so much. I have lived in America for 20 years, just recently returned to live in England. And over the last few years, I used to watch, you know, ever since President Trump was elected, I've watched people that I never thought would behave in an authoritarian manner do exactly that. And I've been shocked and surprised by it. It always confuses me why people are so, you know, so easily subjugated, why they conform so readily to authority. And as I was reading your book, as synchronicity would have it, I happened to receive something that was sent out by an astrologer who was looking at you know, what's happening in society today. And he raised a very good point, which answered some of my questions, because he was talking about Wilhelm Reich and how in his book, The Function of the Organ, authoritarian government structures take over, and usually it starts off with suppressing sexuality.
And you know, I think Reich was really amazingly ahead of his time. However, I think, and I, in my book Sacred Pleasure, which by the way I think you'll love if you read it, because it re-examines sexuality and spirituality, which were once really connected, as you probably know from reading my work,
yes,
and that of others, from the perspective of the partnership domination social scale. But what Reich got wrong was that in men, sexuality is not suppressed. It is distorted. It is,
yes,
women's sexuality that is suppressed. And that's a big difference, because in this book, as well in, you know, in Nurturing Our Humanity, I go back to one of the points I make also in my earlier book, In Sacred Pleasure, that in domination systems, our sexuality, we have the erotization of domination and violence.
Yes.
And it is really, it's like the Pavlov dogs, you know? And it's very, very harmful. And it is part of our socialization. None of this is inevitable. And that is what we really have to, I mean, that's why it's so important, whether it's original sin or selfish genes, it's the same story, isn't it? I mean, religion and secular theories are at odds, but really, they're telling the same story. We're bad, we have to be controlled from the top, right?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so one of the chapters in Nurturing Our Humanity is about the real culture wars. And it's not between right and left, or not between religious and secular, not between socialism and capitalism. I wrote a whole book about that called The Real Wealth of Nations, and I again refer, you know, to that issue. It's domination economics versus an economic system that gives visibility and value to the work of caring for people starting in early childhood and caring for our Mother Earth, which neither capitalism nor socialism do, by the way. It's really within, the struggle is within all of these types of societies, as we think of them, between the domination elements and the partnership elements. And once we understand that, we can really be far, far more effective.
You write about how we need to promote the partnership configuration to build a more equitable, caring and sustainable future. And the first step is constructing the foundations for this partnership future, starting with interactive, mutually supporting cornerstones, of which there are four. Tell us a little bit briefly about these four cornerstones.
Well, we've touched on them, haven't we? The first two. The first one is childhood.
Yes,
I mean,
childhood.
As I said, we need to really take note of what we know today from so-called hard science, right, from neuroscience, that nothing less than how people's brains develop hinges on the interaction of genes and the environment with the environment playing an enormous role. So we know that what children first experience and observe is very different in domination or partnership environments, including, in a domination environment, children learn early on to equate difference, beginning with the difference in form between the male and female form of our species, with either superiority or inferiority, with dominating or being dominated, with being served or serving. And that's a template that's implanted in a child's brain before the brain is developed, much less our cognitive and critical faculties, right? And then it can be applied to every difference, racial, religious. That's why I say whether it's Shia versus Sunni, or Sunni versus Shia, or white versus black, in Burma, it is Buddhist versus Muslim. It doesn't really matter. It's difference. It's the in-group versus the out-group thinking. And it's really rooted in that gender. But we have a gendered system of values. And that's something that we've got to unpack and understand. I mean, why is there always money for prisons, right? Well, I can tell you why. It's the stereotype of the punitive father, right? The punitive head of household. Or there's always money for weapons and wars. Well, that's another domination masculine stereotype, the hero as killer. But somehow there isn't enough money for caring for people's health, for caring for children, for keeping a clean and healthy environment. You know, for both Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, and Karl Marx, the father of socialist theory, that was just reproductive women's work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So It's devalued. And once we understand that, we can really stop devaluing it, because it's what really makes for better lives. And at this point, if we don't take care of nature, our children have no future.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's talk about some of those other cornerstones. I mean, you've got gender relations, economic relations, and narratives and language.
Well, I already started a little with talking about economics, because whether it's so-called neoliberalist capitalism, you know, so-called trickle-down economics, which is really, it's domination economics. It's really going, you can see it in feudal times when people were supposed to content themselves with these scraps dropping from the opulent tables of those on top. Whether it was an old ancient Chinese emperor or an Arab sheik, whether it was feudalism, whether it was autocratic khans, it's all domination economics. And you can have it in socialism too. You know, the two mass applications of socialism in the former Soviet Union and China, they resulted in regimes with neither freedom, very violent regimes, terrible environmental problems. You know, you see it today even in China. But the point of it is we need to move forward and leave behind that gendered system of values to an economic system that recognizes that the real wealth of a nation, of our world, is not financial. You know, like the stock market going up and down, it consists of the contributions of people and of nature. So we need what we haven't had, economics that really support caring for people, starting in childhood, caring for our Mother Earth. And, you know, there are trends in this direction, which is very exciting. But there's, of course, opposition to, look, the nations that have moved most to the partnership side, modern nations now, are nations like Sweden, Finland, and Norway. They're not perfect, but at the beginning of the 20th century, they were so poor, there were famines. And today, they are invariably in the highest ranks of the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Reports. They have a generally high standard of living, far less poverty, far less crime, and they also have more gender equity. They have policies where caring is voted for by both men and women, because the status of women has risen, right? So the status of the feminine has risen. So they have universal health care, very generous paid parental leave for both mothers and fathers, parenting education, elder care with dignity, very high quality early childhood education, which we need, by the way, for our post-industrial age. This country, the United States, is going to pay very dearly if we don't change rapidly and start investing in, we know that high quality human capital, you know, that economists tell us is essential for our knowledge service age, you know, these flexible people who are resilient, who can work in teams, who can adjust to change, including rapid technological change, that largely hinges on the quality of care and education children receive early on. So and I'm working on that. We have introduced a new metric, it's all in my books, really, but the social wealth index is something that we are developing now that can show policymakers what the state of human capacity development is and what investments make for a better or a worse state. You know, the United States, not coincidentally, has the highest child poverty, the highest maternal mortality, and the highest infant mortality rate of any developed nation. And, it invests less than half of what other developed nations do in family support.
Yeah. I want to come back to that after the break. We have to go to the break now. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with cultural historian, social systems scientist, and president of the Center for Partnership Studies, Rianne Eisler, author of the best-selling book, The Chalice and the Blade. And we're talking about her newest book, Nurturing Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Minds, Lives, and Future. We'll be back with more after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Lisa Barry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Rianne Eisler, prior to the break, you were talking about some of the cultures that have turned themselves around and created a partnership system. And it's working pretty well for the most part. And there are other cultures that you write about in the book that have had these peace systems, you know, just as a way of being and living, and they haven't changed. And even though they're not perfect, you know, you tell some wonderful stories about them that really give us great hope. What can we do as individuals? Because, you know, ultimately, it's governments that are going to make these changes. But as an individual, what can we do to spur these changes along? I mean, obviously, we can do things within our own family unit. But outside of that, what can we do to help?
Well, I think that joining the partnership movement is the first step in that is changing our consciousness. You know, for example, Nurturing Our Humanity provides evidence that the evolution of love, played a major role in the emergence of humanity. This is just simply not part of what we're being taught. We have evidence that the default, and we know this from biological and social science, that the default for humans is not domination and violence, but caring, sharing, and nonviolence. Becoming aware of this, helping to change the consciousness of other people, is a very, very important step. We at the Center for Partnership Studies, you know, I mean, it's really all about the last cornerstone, story and language, isn't it? Because what again and again, I think, comes through, doesn't it, when you read my work, is that we've been told the wrong story. And we humans live by stories.
Yes.
So starting to tell the story that's really backed up by the fact, like, why? What is really the partnership configuration? It's not coincidental that these nations, Sweden, Finland, Norway, half of the national legislature is female. And as the status of women rises, men no longer feel it's such a threat to their st- status, to their, quote, masculinity, to also embrace and vote for more caring policies, right? So understanding is, and changing our consciousness, but then also really educating ourselves so that we can each be a leader in the partnership movement. And we at the Center for Partnership Studies have webinars online. You can go to centerforpartnership.org and find out about them. We also have online courses if you are particularly interested in changing economics. Join one of our courses. Go to our website and find out about our social wealth economic indicators. Talk to your legislator about it. Talk to your organizations that you belong to about that we need new, what we do or do not measure makes a difference, okay? And these metrics show the enormous economic value of the work of caring for people, starting in childhood, and caring for our planet. So these are really the first steps. If you are in a position of authority, then introduce a bill to have your state legislature help to develop and adopt the social wealth index. Support bills that are so often marginalized as just women's issues, like paid parental leave. We only have about 4 states now that have them. This is ridiculous. We have to have them nationally. And people need to understand the reality, like the ACEs studies, the adverse childhood experiences. I mean, you read about them, and it's
yes,
depressing, but we can do something about it. We can have parenting classes in high schools. I mean, there's so much that you can do depending on just where you are. But it really starts with leaving behind the old categories, starting to connect the dots.
Yes, indeed. When I was doing some research on you, I saw on Amazon something about the chalice and the blade. Somebody commented, I don't remember who it was, and it said that you have inspired a generation of women and men in the egalitarian society. Sorry, go on.
I wish it were a whole generation, but I certainly seem to have inspired quite a lot of women and men. And you, every one of you can listening, and you, Sandy, who have such a powerful platform here, talk about these things because it is so empowering, isn't it? I mean, people always say to me, I always knew that it was this way, but I didn't have the data.
Yeah, and I think in our hearts we do, and yet what we see all around us, I mean, you know, that's what people are really battling, is, you know, the amount of depression and the sheer scale of the problem, I think, overwhelms people. You know, you've provided a beautiful blueprint in nurturing humanity, but how confident are you that humanity will reach that place within itself where it elects to follow your blueprint?
Well, you know, it's an existential commitment, isn't it? We just simply make the commitment, because if we don't do anything, there's no chance, is there?
Yeah.
So we have to. Am I confident? No, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen. But I do know that the domination system is really toxic. It's toxic to our species. It's toxic to individuals. It's toxic to men, to women, to children. And it doesn't have to be this way.
No.
And once we understand that there is a partnership alternative and that we do have the blueprint, as you said, for building it, starting with these 4 cornerstones, then we can really make it happen. And it won't be easy. but it can be done. You know, human cultures are human creations, for goodness sakes. We can recreate them, not to go back to any so-called good old days, but using the best of technology that we have. Because it isn't the technology, it's what kind of values guide it, right?
Absolutely.
Moving towards the partnership side. It'll never be ideal, but people are constantly being, our default, as I said, is not domination and violence, but caring, sharing, and nonviolence. You know, there's a study I can tell you about where people, actually the so-called pleasure centers in the brain, light up more when people share rather than when they win. It's that simple.
Yeah. We're much happier when we are, you know, helping others and, you know, engaging in selfless acts.
Well, and this is now finally, you know, I mean, science is beginning to look not just at pathology and violence, right, which was obsessed with, because that's what, you know, is, quote, important, right, in domination systems, but looking at love, looking at helpfulness, and the studies are very clear. As you said, people are happier, and it's reflected in their brain neurochemistry.
Mm-hmm. I noticed on your website there was a video. You took part in a webinar, an interactive webinar in 2018, Power With and Power Through, How Women Are Leading Differently for a Just and Caring World. Tell us a little bit about that and what came out of that webinar. What does it really look like to do power differently?
Well, first of all, I'm so glad you brought this up, Sandy, because one of the things that people can do by going to centerforpartnership.org is to actually listen to some of our old prior videos. And we are having a video on the 12th of September we like to have partners with Relationships First on how do we have safe conversations. I mean, very practical things, but so people can, you know, enroll in that. But to get back to that particular video, you know, in my book, The Chalice and the Blade, the title really is symbolic of two ways of looking at power, isn't it? The blade is the power that, how power is power over, right?
Mm-hmm.
Appropriate for the domination system, the power to control, to dominate, to take life. But there's also another power. It's power with and power to, the chalice, the power to not only give life, but to nurture and to really illuminate life. So just being a woman doesn't make you a partnership leader, and men can be partnership leaders, okay? And some men are. I mean, some of the men that I'm in touch with, that I'm working with, are just amazing. But women, because of our socialization, to make others happy, right? Relationship-oriented.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we have that advantage. We are not taught that this is inappropriate, right, as boys are, you know? I mean, don't be soft, don't be feminine, because that makes you a wimp, a sissy. And women perpetuate that, too, in domination cultures, you know?
Yes.
So we do have an advantage because we're really more used to exercising power to empower others rather to disempower them. And by the way, this is very important. There are hierarchies in partnership systems, but there is a distinction. See, you have to coin new language, which is what I've done. The distinction is between hierarchies of domination. We all know those. You know, you better do as you're told or else, right? Whether it's in a family or as an employee or in a rigid domination state, you know, you can get killed. I mean, as you were in the European Middle Ages for just thinking something that wasn't officially condoned, right? But there is also a hierarchy of actualization. Look, we need parents, we need teachers, we need managers, we need leaders. But in a hierarchy of actualization, it's empowering. And the fact that you read this in the management literature today is wonderful, but let's put it all together. It's part of the movement towards partnership, isn't it?
It is. Rianne Eisler, we are reaching the end of our time, sadly. I've really enjoyed talking to you. There's so much more that we could discuss. But what I would like to do is go away and read your book, Sacred Pleasure, and then have you back on the show again to talk about that.
I'd love to do that. I really love that book. And as I said, some of the themes from Sacred Pleasure, like about how sexuality is so, and spirituality,
yes,
are constructed so differently in the partnership or domination context, are in nurturing our humanity. But I'd love to do that, and I've really enjoyed talking with you, Sandy. Thank you.
Thank you. Rianne Eisler, thank you for joining us today. Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination Lives and Future by Rianne Eisler and Douglas P. Fry is published by Oxford University Press, and it came out just about 2 weeks ago, and it is
well worth reading.
Brand new.
You can get it on Kindle if that's your preference. And if you're going to buy The Chalice and the Blade, get the latest printing because there's a new epilogue in it.
Thank you. And for more information about Rianne Eisler and her work, you can visit her website, RianneEisler.com, and you can also go to thecenterforpartnership.org. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thank you for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.